Hello, my name is Debbie Boone, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, The Bend, where we explore how successful people navigated the path and emerged in a better place when life threw them an unexpected twist. It's inspired by one of my favorite sayings, "The bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the curve." These conversations will hopefully help you and inspire you to embrace your personal bend and to flourish. I hope you enjoy it, and if you need help with your own personal navigation and you're in veterinary medicine, please feel free to reach out to me at Debbie Boone, 2Manage Vets Consulting. Enjoy the bend and be inspired by our wonderful guest. Welcome. Well, good morning or good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this episode of The Bend. Today, my guest, I'm very excited to have because she is actually a pioneer. Crystal Schaefer is a distinguished registered veterinary technologist, actually. She has 2 decades in the field. You get to the point where you don't want to tell people that. So I don't want to tell people how long I've been doing this, Crystal. She graduated with honors, earned an Associate of Applied Science in Vet Technology from Cedar Valley. Then she continued her academic journey, Bachelor of Applied Science in Veterinary Technology from St. Pete. Then she served as the Director of Emergency and Critical Care at NOAA's 24-Hour Animal Hospital for 10 years. Then was promoted to the position of Director of Technology Technician Development for all 11 multidisciplinary practices, encompassing 9 NOAA's animal hospitals and 2 veterinary specialty and emergency care facilities. And this is where I met Crystal, because I came up to NOAA's to do some training and talk to all their leadership team and then their front desk managers about hospitality and healthcare, just as my book launched. So I was really impressed with her and the whole NOAA's group, as a matter of fact, because training is so important to this practice, and I'm sure this is why they flourish. But she also is Recover, Basic, and Advanced on life support. And then, here's the big then. She decided to go back to school and pursue a graduate degree. And so she is one of the first Master of Veterinary Clinical Care technologists in the United States. This is basically the equivalent of a human physician's assistant in the veterinary realm. And as you all know, there's been a lot of controversy about this position and what they will do and what's the point of it all. So today we're going to talk to Crystal. We're going to get her viewpoint of it and talk a little bit about what made her pursue this avenue. Obviously, she's kind of like me, like knowledge is, I just want it, right? I just want it all. So Crystal, thank you for being on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity.
Sure. So tell us, why VetMed? How did you get started?
Oh gosh, it's so funny because I always ask all the nurses that join our company, why VetMed? And the only rule is you can't say because you love animals. So now here the tables are kind of turned. Well, my story is a long one. We'll summarize it here. When I was a child, there were periods in my life where my safety was compromised. My mom married several men. Guys were in and out of our home. We were very poor. We were homeless a couple of times. My dad left when I was very, very young, leaving my mom to rear 2 children by herself on a meager minimum wage income. And so, you know, just like many in our field, having suffered childhood adverse experiences, I lent my spiritual growth to animals, being able to connect with them on a level that was easier for me than it was to people. Animals were a constant in my life growing up. They didn't judge, right? We hear this all the time. And so I vowed that I would at some point in my life devote my life to animal advocacy and kind of what that would bring me in my future.
You know, that's not an uncommon story. And when you said that, I said, yeah, I think that we have a lot of people who were damaged in their youth, and animals were their salvation, and that safety net where you knew unconditional love was always there for you no matter what. And so I think that's really a theme that is pervasive in the field, especially in the technician, because they want the hands-on. That's really where they want to be nursing. And so, you know, you decided to go to tech school, and tell me how you got involved with NOAAs. Was that one of your, like your first?
Oh gosh.
It's a really exceptional place.
Yeah, it really is. I've been there for 21 years, and I'm very blessed that I came across NOAAs. Actually, I started my career out. I did this vocational certification to be an assistant. So I was a CVA for about for 10 years before I actually went back and got my degree as a veterinary technician. But my journey started a long time ago, 25 years ago. After I obtained my CVA, I actually interviewed at a local Banfield. And I remember in my interview, the veterinarian himself interviewed me. And I remember telling him, I know that the thermometer goes in the butt, but I have no idea how long or how far it goes up there. And he goes, you're hired. So that was my beginning in veterinary medicine, if you will. I was at Banfield for a couple of years. I was promoted to their lead nurse position. And then he sold. And I thought, well, wow, this is an opportunity for me to get out of PetSmart and really try my hand at other disciplines in veterinary medicine. So I moved on to a large multidisciplinary specialty hospital here in Indianapolis. And I was there for about 2 years. And I was a float nurse. So I spent a week in oncology, a week in cardiology, a week in surgery, a week in emergency critical care, a week in ophthalmology. So I really got internal medicine, oncology. So I really got my sea legs, if you will, on advanced nursing techniques. And that's where it sparked my interest that maybe I need to go back to school and obtain a license in this because I'm actually really good at this. Then things changed. The owner of that disciplinary practice sold to corporate. And so I was like, okay, do I want to stay with this or do I kind of want to see what's out there? So I remember I interviewed with a VCA and I interviewed with a NOAAs. And this is so funny. And I can't believe that I'm admitting this to you and everybody listening. I'm very spiritual. And I remember interviewing for both locations. Both locations offered me similar pay, similar benefits, you know. But it was because it was NOAAs and it was a spiritual kind of faith-based thing. I took that as maybe I need to go with NOAAs and let's just see. And here I am 21 going on 22 years later, I'm still with NOAAs.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Well, when Susie asked me to come up and speak, for some reason, I kept calling it Noah's Ark Animal Hospital.
Yeah.
It's just Noah's. I went, okay. You know, it just popped into my head that way. So I totally get the Noah's aspect of it. Something that you said I thought was really important is you had gone through and you had been nursing in a really intense atmosphere of all kinds of specialty and still went to technology school. And I feel like that is, there's a whole lot of talented, you know, kind of homegrown nurses out there, but they're like, you know, why do I need to go to school? So I want you to address that because you were like advocate for school. Tell me why.
So Dr. Mike Thomas, who is the president of NOAAs Animal Hospitals, Veterinary Specialty and Emergency Cares, and our community outreach practices, I was working with him about, I want to say 2 years into working at NOAAs, and he was actually, you know, seeing clients and doing surgery, and I was his assistant that day. And he said to me, where do you want to be at in 5 years, young lady? And I kind of thought contemplatively about it, and I said, I would love to be the person that aspiring nurses come to ask for advice, and I think I'd love to teach. And he goes, well, you know, you have to be licensed to do that. And I was like, yeah, I just can't afford it. Come talk to me at the end of your shift. So at the end of my shift, I was very nervous and meek and went up to his office that was grandiose and large with all of his accomplishments. And here I am just an assistant, right? And he offered to pay my way through tech school.
Wow.
Because he saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. And so he actually paid my way through my associate's degree through Cedar Valley College School of Veterinary Technology there in Lancaster, Texas. It was the first AHA kind of induced or accredited distance education program, if you will. And by God, I graduated with high honors, 4.0 GPA. And that's why I went to school, honestly.
Yep. That's awesome. That's awesome. I don't understand why more veterinary practices don't invest in their assistants to get them there. When I was managing the last hospital, it was a large hospital, 11 doctor practice, and we had four assistants going through tech school and that we were, paying for, but we had kind of a contract that said, you know, you work for us after you get out and we reimburse you for your books and stuff. So yeah, I mean, it is very difficult to find technicians and technologists. So grow your own. There's no reason not to do that. And grow your people. And obviously you are a believer in growing your people because this is what you do for NOAA.
This is what I do. Yeah. And I will say I did have to sign a contract, and that contract did indicate that I had to stay 3 years past becoming registered. And it took me a long time, but gosh, I'm still here.
Yeah. Yep. And you just keep getting more and more advanced degrees. So tell me a little bit about, making these decisions, because I feel like a lot of times we get stuck in decision gridlock and we're really afraid to step out into the great unknown. Or, kind of like you said, well, I can't afford it. And even vocalizing that made it possible because somebody was there listening for that. And to hear you say, I want this, but this is the barrier. So how do we break down that barrier? Because a lot of times people don't even realize that you want it, but they'll be willing to step up and help. So tell me how you kind of, work through that, and then working full-time, I'm assuming, getting a 4.0 while you're going to school. How challenging was that?
Well, I tell you, I live my life that if you are afraid to jump, if you're afraid to fall, you're never going to jump. I am also a mother. So I'm a mother of three children. And so when I went to school to get my associate's degree, I had a little one. He was 5 years old. Oh. And yeah. And so the challenge with education was not necessarily the coursework. It was doing it while being a mother, because coursework has to happen at home, at night when everybody's asleep and you're exhausted. But I just kept, it's so funny, I can't believe I'm admitting this either. I used to write my name with RVT behind it.
All right.
And I would write it over and over and over and over again as a way to encourage myself that I'm going to do this. Yeah. I am totally going to do this. And it's going to show my kids that they can do it too. And when I graduated with my associate's degree, I was the first college graduate in my family.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I just kept writing my name. I prayed a lot. Failure was not an option for me. It was just going to happen. It was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm curious because you are a teacher, and mm-hmm. I wonder about, obviously you have a lot of self accountability and self discipline in order to do this, but mm-hmm. was there accountability from the doctor who was affording, your education? Was he going like, Crystal, you gotta meet these timelines? Because I'm telling you, I've been in practice where the practice owner paid for somebody to go to school, gave them no timeline, gave them a laptop, and they ended up using the laptop to let their children play games on and never went to school.
Oh my gosh.
No accountability there. So I'm curious as to the accountability that was there.
Yes. Yeah. So in our contract, this is so funny. He said, if every class you pass with a B or better, you'll get a 10-cent raise. So being a single mom at that time, a 10 cent raise for every class. Oh my gosh, that's going to be like $3 more an hour by the time I'm done with this.
Yeah.
So that was kind of my encouragement, you know, like, and every semester I would see pay increases coming on my check. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, and at the end of the contract, he was like, and then I'll give you a big raise once you become an RVT. And so, man, it was life-changing for me as a single mom.
Life-changing. Well, and what a smart motivator too, that it was,
the
carrot was not so far away that like, well, when you finish, I'll give you money. But it was the carrot was close and you could make those incremental goals. And I think that's a big mistake that a lot of management people make is making the goal so far away from the moment that, you know, a 10 cent raise doesn't seem like much, but a 10 cent raise times five classes.
Correct.
Make a difference, right? And that's a
yes. I mean, I went from balancing my checkbook and literally having one penny until my next paycheck to having like $50 between my next paycheck. And that was such, I remember feeling like I made it.
Yeah. Glorious. This is glorious.
Glorious.
I love it. So I love to ask people this question. What do you consider to be your biggest career mistake?
I don't know if you're going to like this answer, Debbie. Okay. So, as you mentioned in the beginning of this interview or meeting, when I was the first non-DVM director of emergency and critical care for our hospitals, and that was a really great accomplishment and one that I was successful at. And so I remember being asked if I wanted to be a practice manager for not only the emergency department, but for all of it. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to slay this. I got this too. Then I realized after 2 years into it, I was turning into somebody that I couldn't recognize anymore. Mm-hmm. It just engulfed me with the amount of fires. I mean, I was running an emergency critical care, a general practice, a grooming salon, and a boarding facility.
Oh my gosh.
By myself. And it was the largest grossing emergency hospital in Indianapolis.
Oh, wow.
So it just became so much where everything became a priority that nothing was a priority. And I just remember thinking, this is not who I want to be as a person. I don't want to go home and not have time for my own animals. I don't want to come home and be short with my children and my husband because I put out 10 fires and got cussed out 3 times by 3 different clients, you know? And so I think, and I don't ever want to look at something as a mistake. I truly believe that every situation in life is either a learning moment or a teaching moment. This was definitely a learning moment for me, that management to that capacity was not my cup of tea. It's not what I was born to do. My purpose was to do what I'm doing today.
Yes.
I had to go through that to recognize that purpose.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's such a great point, because sometimes we look at things and we get ourselves involved in things and we go, God grief, what a train wreck that was. Why did But then if you look back on it, it is a teaching moment. And I was teaching a class to a bunch of pre-veterinary students at NC State one day. And I went, you guys, they're all like so laser focused on going to vet school, but you know, only like 10% of them will get in. And then there's 900 of them that won't. So what are you going to do, the 900? And I was talking to them about other options, you know, like practice management and owning practices. You know, in some states you can own a practice as a non-DVM. And it was really enlightening to them. They never thought about it, never considered they could do anything other than be a DVM. But I said, a lot of times your career path is not this straight arrow. It's more like a drunken sailor on a Saturday night. And you just like the place. But every place you go, you learn something. And I mean, I've managed retail fabric shops. I managed a jewelry department. I managed restaurants growing up. My family owned a bunch of restaurants. And so I grew up doing that. So, you know, you learn hospitality from that, from the jewelry store. I learned inventory control. I mean, when you're doing $10,000 diamonds, really you have inventory down pat and
yes.
on that. So those are all things that I brought into management. And it does take, a certain mindset, I think, to be able to manage and compartmentalize work out of home, and also to delegate appropriately so you don't bring that stuff home. You've empowered enough people to be able to manage a lot of those things. And you, of course, jumped into management, which I would have never recommended at that level, from zero to over.
No, yeah, it was almost like the Amy Newfield, oops, I became a manager type of situation. It was a good technician, so let's promote her as a manager and see what happens. And you have to realize too, I was in my 20s
Oh, gosh.
when that transitioned, so I hadn't even begun to even know myself, let alone how to manage this giant hospital with all these aspiring nurses and CSRs. It was just a lot.
I can't imagine. And emergency is such a different animal anyway, because
Oh yeah.
everybody is upset in emergency just because
Oh yeah.
of the beast. And it really takes a unique person, I think, to manage emergency, to manage the front desk in emergency, and to work in emergency. And I ran an ER for 3.5 years, so I completely understand what that's like. I used to laugh and say at 3 o'clock in the morning, there are three options for clients: drunk, high, or crazy. And all of
Pretty
them,
much.
no
I
money.
mean, we're in the urban Indianapolis, so you can two plus two, right?
Exactly right. Exactly right. Okay, so let's talk about your new degree. And of course, I told you Tucker would join, and he keeps
Tucker.
insisting on popping up here and being in my lab. So hello to
Yes.
Tucker. So let's talk about, where you go from now, because you've got your master's degree, you're already training. How many employees are at NOAA's now?
So we are close to 300. I oversee about 197, 198 nursing staff. And when I say nurse, I'm clumping in registered technicians as well as veterinary assistants. And I'm also overseeing about 30 technician assistants, which are kind of like kennel attendants, but I've trained them to become the assistants of the technician. So they do more than just clean cages, right?
Yeah, they expect that
So
of him. So, yeah.
so I oversee all of them. So it's a full-time job, of course. That's why
Yes.
we have an entire team. I happen to be the director of the team, and then I have two young ladies that help me make sure that we get to all of our practices. And when you were here, we had 11. We now have 12. We have the first community outreach surgery center that's not just spays and neuters. So it's orthopedics, advanced soft tissues. They help me. They're my right hands, and yeah.
Because NOAA's is also very invested in charitable works. They not only are, a for-profit, but they also have a whole system in place to help people who cannot afford. And I think that probably helps with your retention, because the people who get in vet med like to do good in the world. And you guys definitely have a vehicle to do that, along with all the other things you do. So tell me a little bit about, the master's program, because I'm curious as to, since you have been through the technologist program, what was different? What was more than where you were?
Yeah, so I like you've said, I've been to Cedar Valley, I went to St. Pete. They were all really fantastic programs. I got my master's of veterinary clinical care through Lincoln Memorial University, and a lot of people have reached out to me asking it, is the curriculum worth the extra student loans? And the answer to that is yes. My teachers included boarded diplomats, VTSs. So it's interesting, and when we get into the controversy of VTS, VTSs were teaching me, right? So my grad class for anesthesia was the entire board of the VTS Anesthesia Academy. They all took part of it. They all like shared the burden, I guess, if you will, and they all had their own different assignments, their own lectures. It was a beautiful program. My surgery class was taught by a VTS and a diplomat surgeon. It was well worth it.
That's so interesting. So now, how do you feel like your next career step will be? If somebody
Debbie,
comes,
I'm sorry.
that's okay.
Yes, I'm nervous.
Yeah, we could. We're buffering a little bit too, so I can
Okay.
we may have to clip a little bit. So tell me a little, like, how do you feel like you would use this master's degree if you went back on the floor and were doing PA kind of work in the veterinary hospital?
So a lot of people have asked too, like, what is so different now when from a bachelor's degree to having a master's degree? In my role, nothing has changed. All it has done has solidified to the DVMs that I work with that they can trust me. Not only can they trust me, they trust what I'm teaching the other technicians. I mean, as you know, our hospital utilizes our technicians to the top of their license. I mean, our technicians unblock Tomcats, we're suturing skin. We're placing intraosseous catheters, central lines. I mean, we're doing all of that. So in my day-to-day role, it hasn't changed. What has changed is the way that my own community of professionals view me. And some of that's positive, and some of that has been negative. And I've been a little bit disheartened by some of the political banter that's been going on. So nothing has changed in my day to day. I didn't go to get my graduate degree because I had something to prove that I wanted to outshine or outdo, or I wanted to become a veterinary professional associate. That was never my goal. My goal was to show the underdogs that they too can climb to the top, and that we don't really have a glass ceiling like we once did. And so that was the whole genesis of me getting my master's degree. And then things started slowly unfolding. What does that mean? How do I view that? Do I see myself in that capacity? And I do. I do think that there is a place, as you call them, mid-level practitioners. I do think there's a place for that. Just like when VTSs first came on the scene, was there a place for a VTS? Did they come with opposition? You know, when we look at human medicine, I know that the nurse practitioners in human medicine faced multiple opposition. In fact, their own licensing board wouldn't even support them. They had to go and seek accreditation outside of their own network of
Oh
professionals.
my
But
goodness.
they did it. They did it, and they were trailblazers. And because they did it, the healthcare for humans has been transformed. We can go in and see our nurse practitioner. We have an option, you know. So I do think there is a place for it.
Let's talk about the controversy because, I, like
Sure.
you, know a lot of licensed technicians. A lot of my friends, my close friends, are VTS in, dentistry, internal medicine, emergency and critical care. And their great frustration for, not particularly themselves, because the ones that I know typically are consulting and speaking and teaching, and but some of them are still working in practice, is the lack of utilization of the technician and certainly the VTS. I mean, I can remember reading a Facebook post one day. I'm on a lot of different groups, and this young lady had just finished getting her VTS in internal medicine, and people were congratulating her. It's quite an accomplishment. It's really difficult
Sure.
to do. And they said, "Oh, did you get a raise? What, how much raise did you get when you did?" And she said, "Nothing." The fact that this young lady had gone through all this effort and educated herself in internal medicine specialty and then got no financial benefit from it, from the practice that she was working in, I just was astonished by that. And it was so, it's so short-sighted on the practice owner or whoever she was working for. It could have been a corporate deal to not recognize that. And I don't know if it, went on later, but there was a lot of certainly a lot of commiseration with it from the other technicians on the group and a lot of anger truly about the lack of recognition of the effort. So, I think you're fortunate that you work for somebody that does recognize effort. And that's incredibly valuable to team retention and to team growth. And if you want to leverage your team to the top of their skills, then you need to make sure that you're rewarding that because otherwise somebody else is going to at this stage in the game.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about that. I mean, what kind of pushback have you heard being this pioneer, as I said, in this position, this master's position?
Sure. So some of the things that are most popular are, first, we need to focus on technician utilization and standardized title protection. That's probably the number one thing that I hear over and over and over again. Like, before we can move on to the idea of a mid-level practitioner, first we have to do A and B. And here's what I have to say about that. I agree. It is unfortunate that our states are not united as one front. However, there's a couple of things that I just want the other side to realize, that if we, the definition of insanity is doing something over and over and over again and expecting different results. We have been riding this horse until it is dead. Okay. Yes, we're making progress in some states. I happen to be in Indiana, which is one of five states that's title protected. It's a $5,000 Class C misdemeanor to represent yourself as a technician in Indiana. And I don't know, because I understand, but I also understand that we have limited access to care, especially in our rural communities. Mm-hmm. I think there needs to be an avenue or an option for clients. And I don't know what this looks like. You know, I think that needs to involve a residency program. It needs to involve a standardized board exam. It needs to involve, DVM oversight for X amount of years after obtaining a VPA. I think there needs to be a lot of things in line. I'm not proposing we go and stop right now and do it tomorrow, but I am proposing that those states that do have title protection and are doing the appropriate thing for their technicians, why can't those states start kind of trailblazing or pioneering the concept or the ideology of what it might look like to increase access to care with these individuals that have this expertise and this ability to assist? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I'm at with it. Another controversial comment that I've heard a lot about are that, how can we advocate for mid-level practitioners when technicians aren't created equally? And that's true in our own state. We have brick and mortar schools that only have a 66% pass rate on the VT&E, whereas Purdue has 99% pass rate on the VT&E. So the curriculum certainly isn't created equal. So why don't we start there?
Yeah.
Why don't we start increasing the educational demands or requirements of what it means to be a technician? Right now I have I'm writing a textbook, a collegiate textbook right now for veterinary technicians, and I'm a co-author. And one of the conversations has been, well, do we have to define what photons are in our book? Why? Why don't we elevate the level of education that we're giving to veterinary nurses, so when they do come out, they're more prepared to take on more of a responsibility? When I have to define photons to an associate degree collegiate student, I think there's a bigger problem than what we may even realize.
Yeah. Well, I will have to agree with you. There is such a variety of skills that come through these programs, and some of them are less than optimal. Some of them, like the Purdue program, which I love, Mayor Shears is a friend of mine.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Kara Burns is there. I mean, like, where can you go wrong with that group?
Right, right, right.
And they're also trained side by side with veterinarians, which is a point that I have made to any dean who will listen to me, and a few do. But until we teach, this is a partnership. We cannot teach dance partners in two different buildings.
Right.
You have to teach them to dance together. And when you're teaching veterinarians to be technicians in vet school, which is what they're doing because they're free labor as they get into those, third and fourth years, and you don't have enough licensed technicians who are in the vet schools to do the technician work. I was at Washington State many years ago, and one of the licensed technicians was in charge of the exotics. She had 50 patients to care for.
That's too much.
Yeah, they were lizards and frogs and, you know, things.
Okay.
Like that. They were still patients and they were still there. And you know, of course, the veterinary students are doing a great deal of the nursing care for that. But this is what my belief is. One of the reasons why technicians are not utilized is because doctors aren't trained to do it. They don't know how to do it. And then there's also the pushback about, well, this is my license and it's not their license. And if they make a mistake, then it's on me. And I completely agree with that. One of my veterinary friends happened to be at the Arizona board the other day, and a new grad veterinarian, she's been out like a year and a half, has a spay just go wrong, and come to find out that the veterinary technician had overinflated the cuff. And so the animal died, and the owner, of course, was distraught, and the veterinarian was in charge of it. But she didn't check, right? She didn't check. So, but maybe that was a poorly trained graduate of a technician school. In fact, a friend of mine, Mary Berg, who I'm sure you're familiar with, is a BTS in dentistry, was teaching at one of the schools and quit. She was so disgusted with the curriculum and the lack of a true learning, I guess, that was going on at the school. She said, I just can't put my name behind it. And I think that curriculum might have closed. But yes, the standardization of the curriculum, I know, is supposed to be there, but the level of training is not there, because some people don't know what they're doing to get out. And there was one in North Carolina where I was working for so many years. And I think that a lot of people would get into it, and they would get up to about the time when you had to go into the laboratory. And that was when everybody quit, because we would have them go, oh, I've got like a semester, or I've got two semesters, but then I got lab science of it. No, I don't want to do it anymore. But, you know, this is the reason I think that on-the-job trained nurses are certainly capable of doing the physical act of care, but when something goes wrong, they can't problem solve to think, and they don't have that
theoretical background.
Yeah, the background that says, okay, how do I problem solve my way out of this? And, you know, it's kind of like me as a manager. I've been through so much stuff with management, but if I didn't have this fake background behind me, you would see about 150 books just and about another 200 on my Kindle, because I'm constantly learning how to do my work better. And when people ask me as a consultant, you know, how do you do these things? Then I have the deep knowledge that pulls that somewhere from my brain. It comes out and goes, this is how you problem solve that. Mm-hmm. So that, I think that is the whole point of all of this. Let me have such depth of knowledge that no matter what gets thrown at me, I can get myself out of it. And I
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some other things that I've heard, I was recently at a national conference and attended a lecture. And the presenter, right on this person's screen in front of thousands of people, it said that the LMU MVCC program does not require you to be a licensed technician. That's 100% inaccurate. In fact, I had to show proof of licensure before I even applied for the program. And so it's just a lot of misinformation. I've heard people on social media, you know, saying, how could these schools steal these technicians' monies? Look, I'm 43 years old. No one stole my money. I was doing the whole time. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I'm glad I got my master's degree. Mm-hmm. And when it comes, and then, you know, then you hear the old, well, VTSs are already here. They should be the ones up for VPA or mid-level practitioners before anybody else. Now, I don't like clumping people together, just like I don't want to be clumped together as that. But I do think there are some VTSs that probably feel that way, and rightfully so. But the way that I look at it, I have to go back to the human medicine structure. I mean, my cousin's a human anesthesiologist, and then I have a cousin that's an MD, and I have a cousin that's a nurse practitioner. And there are specialists in human medicine. There's RN and RN anesthetists, there's dental hygienists, There are radiology technicians. There are specialized fields in healthcare. VTSs, to me, represent that specialized care within veterinary medicine. But when we look at what a nurse practitioner encompasses and entails, it's a broad knowledge base of all the disciplines that they're in. So if I had to be asked, and this isn't because I have a master's degree, but if I was to be asked who should be up for consideration, it's got to be somebody that has a graduate degree in animal medicine, not these pointed specialists. Mm-hmm. Now, could they function as a nurse practitioner like your VTS in internal medicine? Sure. They could be a nurse practitioner for internal medicine cases. Absolutely. Could the VTS in clinical care apps or clinical practice? Absolutely. They would make the most sense, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But then you have really specialty things like radiology or diagnostic imaging. You've got anesthesiology, surgery. You know, so that's just where I think most of the argument lies, is how to divvy that up.
Yeah. And I love the fact that the school used VTSs in those very
100%
specialties to train, because they are deep in that, you know, very deep in that knowledge. And that's a very smart move. That's who you want training that.
Yeah. And that should be flattering to the VTS community.
Yes.
That they were asked to lead graduate programs.
Right. Yeah.
So I just wish that one day we could sit at the table and have Thanksgiving dinner together. I just hate all this political back and forth. Really? I mean, we just need to come on now.
Well, there's a lot of people involved in it who really shouldn't be involved in it, because it's not them, you know. And as far as how you spend your money, I used to tell my people all the time about prejudging a client. I said, that's incredibly arrogant of you. Mm-hmm. It's none of your business how people spend their money. And if they want to spend it on their animal doing whatever it is, then okay, you let them do that, because it's their money. And the same thing goes for if you want to get as much education as you want, then go do it. It's your money. Do what you
want. That's what I want to do. I constantly want to improve my nursing care and my theoretical knowledge. If the day comes that I can use that as a mid-level practitioner, kudos to me. I thought smart in the beginning and got my master's degree. If it doesn't end up happening, still kudos to me. I'm able to provide a level of nursing care that I think is very authentic and more theoretically based than the associate and bachelor programs combined.
Mm-hmm. And you're training 190 people to work to the top of their license and have a whole group of veterinarians who trust that they know what they're doing, which I think is incredibly important. So it's a model that could go out into the world. I actually was talking to one of my former employees last night. We call periodically and check up on each other. And I said, one of the things that I learned working in the first practice that I worked in was how to build a model of how to do it right, how to have a great culture, how to empower your team, how to delegate appropriately, how to have clients who are incredibly compliant. We had an 87% compliance rate on preventative care because everybody on the team was so invested in promoting it and told the same story. So it was a model that I learned and I could take out into the world and start to teach individual practices and know that it worked. And when I changed jobs, I did it again and knew that it worked. So the same thing is happening here, is you are training a model that the people who work for you, you know, if they go and move somewhere else, they know how to work to the top of their license and they've been trained at that point. And they're not going to be satisfied to work for somebody that makes them clean kennels and mop floors all day.
That's right.
Right? They're going to expect what they're doing now.
I tell all my technicians, we're going to change the world today.
Yeah. Well, you've got a pretty big cadre at 198.
Yes.
That's a good start. Well, we just eat the elephant a bite at a time. And sometimes I think we don't have patience. But I started working in veterinary medicine in 1985. In fact, I'm thinking about doing just a little video blog about some history, because You know, 40 years ago, there was a dramatic difference between what we could do and what we can do now. It's amazing. But being patient and seeing the progress that has been made from a long view. And yesterday I was doing an interview with Sebastian Gobber, and Sebastian started DigiTales. And one of the exercises he does with his team is to say, 200 years from now, what will this be like? And he said, because we can look 200 years back and see how dramatic things have changed in 200 years, as far as even human medicine, veterinary medicine. I mean, we go back to Hippocrates, but what will it look like 200 years from now when we pull AI in and things are so dramatically different? I'm like, what a great exercise, because that gives you today's vision and say, 200 years from now, Crystal, we'll look back and Crystal was one of the first, but now we have all these, different.
It's so
Thing is,
exciting.
this is how we go forward to the future, because we're goal setting for 200 years from now.
Yes,
Yeah.
yes.
And patience is the name of the game sometimes, because,
Yes.
but one of the things that I found really interesting in talking to Sebastian was they just did the AI study for AHA, and they found out that veterinarians are using AI on the equivalent of what people who work in tech do. So we're
Wow.
right there on top of ChatGPT for all kinds of cool stuff. And I
Yeah.
think we'll continue to use it even more and more.
For
And
sure.
it saves us time and saves us effort. And then we can use our time to really do great care for our patients and for our clients, All right. So what advice would you give someone facing big life decisions? Because you've certainly jumped in the water a lot of times.
I do like to open up a can of worms. I was once told to seize every opportunity that's presented to you, no matter how large or small, no matter how, I'm not going to be able to do that. Something may be. I have led my personal and professional life by that advice, to seize every opportunity. I mean, I have taken hold of every single opportunity that has been offered to me, and will continue to do so. I was also told once that your largest weakness is your biggest strength gone awry. And so when I think about that, my areas of improvement or weakness, or I'm talking to another nurse or something like that, is weaknesses are not negative. It's your strengths just going haywire. And so I think if we look at it and kind of readjust our view on that, I think it makes life a lot easier.
I love that. I love that.
Oh, and Eleanor Roosevelt always reminds us to do something every day that scares you.
That
So
scares you. That's
I try to honor her that way.
exactly right. Yeah. Sometimes it's just talking to a disgruntled client. It's a little scary. But yeah, I mean, it's I've always talked to people about things that I don't know about. And I feel like that gives you a little bit of general knowledge about a little bit of everything, but it also gives you a network of super smart people that
Gosh,
can
yes.
answer the deep questions on subject matter experts. So I, just making connections with people who are not like you, who are, so far above you that you're like, oh my gosh, they would never talk to me, but they will,
But
right?
they
They
will.
will. Because everybody likes to, when they get to that point, I think they like to give back. And I know I certainly do. I love to talk to people and kind of coach them a little bit about in their career and how to meet their goals. And I know you do, because you teach every day how to do those things. So yeah, I think if we go through life with selfishness, we will always be miserable. But
100%.
if we go through life going, how can I be of help? How can I serve in some way? It really is good for our mental health and our well-being. And if you want to know how to get happy in vet med, go do something for somebody. Many years ago, this really struck me, and I'm sure that you will relate to it, because I watched Michael J. Fox give the keynote at VMX. And he,
I was there.
Were you there? Do you remember he
Yes.
stumbled up the stairs? And when he
Yes.
got to the podium, his knuckles were bleeding because he had stumbled up the metal set of steps to get there. And he stood up there and with his tremors and all the things that were going on with his body. And he said, don't feel sorry for yourself. If you do, go out and do something for somebody else and you will no longer feel sorry for yourself. You know, you will come out of that time. And that is the key to the kingdom. Just go do something
Absolutely.
For somebody else.
Absolutely. And to add to that, to think that, yes, I've made it. I'm the best. I need to be recognized. I'm better than this person because I have this education or I have this license or I have this certification, I think is also inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much more to learn.
Well, there's always somebody smarter than you.
Always.
Always. They don't get too grandiose about it.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And usually they're very humble about it and willing to teach. And that's what, that's really what makes them great. All right. So now it's time for the fun fact. Do you have a secret talent, a favorite song, something people might be surprised to know about you? I'm surprised that you're 40 some years old because you look so.
Thank you. I have a huge green thumb. So I have over 200 house plants.
Oh my gosh.
I have multiple gardens on my property. I have pollinator gardens. I have habitats for frogs and toads, and I have habitats for chipmunks. And I just, my peace, my zen is my hands in the soil. Like that is just my zen. I learned a long time ago that my hobby should not include animals. Not that that's bad for those who do, but for my mental state, I had to separate what I do for a living and I had to find another hobby, right? So that's kind of what I branched onto and held onto. My mom is a landscaper. She helped landscape the Indianapolis Zoo. She's just very good. And my biological father is an arborist. And so I was always around trees and plants my entire life. And then of course, animals. And so I'm the animal person and the rest of my folks are, landscapers and such, but yeah, that's something special that that not a lot of people know that about me.
I'm a fan of dirt therapy myself. And whenever
yes.
I travel out of town in the summer, my husband goes, I can't believe I have to water all these plants because there's just pots and plants everywhere.
I've heard it.
Yes.
I have so many plants now that I can come in and like sneak one, a new one.
Nobody knows.
My husband will never know.
Well, I will actually pick them up off the side of the road. When I'm walking the dog, if somebody has thrown out a plant, I'm like, I think I can bring that back. And I have two hydrangeas that are now getting ready to bloom. They're going to be beautiful. And I picked them up off the road where somebody had thrown them out after Mother's Day. So I'm going to take Tucker for a walk in the neighborhoods a few weeks after Mother's Day where people have managed to kill these things or think they have and see what else I can pick up off of the street.
People will give me their plants that they can no longer care for or don't know how to care for. I recently inherited a 23-year-old 12-foot Norfolk pine tree that now in my dining room.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
I know. My husband's like, who has a pine tree in their dining room? I'm like, I do.
I have a 6-foot Madagascar palm in my living room that one of the lady who hired me, and this always makes me think of Jean, she's passed on now, but she loved palm trees and succulents. And she gave me this palm when it was this big in a pot. And I kept it on the side of my bathtub, which was very happy. And it grew and it grew and it grew. And finally, I had to put it in a big pot. And now it's really grown. So it has gone from, 6 inches to 6 feet in that time frame. But
yes.
Yeah, I love that about plants because they do last, if you care for them, a long time.
Yes.
And always bring back memories of the people that gave them to you.
Yes.
So. Yeah, I hope that plant lives until I don't. And then maybe I'll give it to you.
I'll take it.
Okay. That's the deal. All right, Crystal. Well, thank you so much for your time today. And
yes.
I'm excited about where this goes and what you do with it and the pioneer that you are. I'm sure that you'll probably nurture a bunch more in the NOAA's group.
Yes.
The same program. You'll probably have slight. Tell me about that now, Crystal, and how was it, and how
Yeah.
did I do it? So we'll see where it goes. But thank
We'll
you very
see.
much for being a first and for
Yeah.
sharing it with my audience.
You're very welcome. It's been an interesting journey for sure, and I'm super excited to see, like you said, where does the future go, and it is in my hopes that in my lifetime, I will see higher increased utilization, and I hope we do meet the goal of everybody unified under title protection. And then maybe, just maybe, there'll be enough time let yet in my lifespan to see the fruition of mid-level practitioners. So,
We always live in hope, right?
yes.
Thanks again, Crystal. And thank you to the audience for listening to this episode of The Bend. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll put Crystal's bio and all her contact information in case you have questions for her after the show. And we thank you very much, as always, for your attention.